We're talking more about life on this earth, this life that we experience for a short while. But what's his main thought? What's his thesis? What's he trying to prove? All right, everything is pointless. That's one way to say it. What he's going to do for us is go through that great experiment before we hopefully go through that great experiment to figure out, what do we do in this world? What's our purpose? What brings us happiness? What makes us feel fulfilled? And the opposite of that is what he has found so far. He's found a bunch of things that are vanity, that are empty, that are meaningless. And name a few of those things that he so far has found has been meaningless so far. Wisdom. Wisdom, okay. Pleasure.
Building.
All right, work. Those are the three main ones we've covered so far. And then we kind of took a side note to talk about something in regards to work that's on the peripheral, but it's important because it shows something very significant. That was in chapter 3. He mentioned to us that work is significant. And then here in chapter 4, before verse 17, where we are this morning, there is a particular phrase that's very significant. And we talked a little bit about that, and then we dove into it a little bit last time. And that was the idea of working for a very specific purpose. What was the vain purpose that Solomon mentioned of working in this chapter last week? We have a colloquial expression, keeping up with the Joneses, right? What does that mean? All right, so a lust or desire after what people that are your neighbors, people that are around you have, so therefore you work to acquire those things. They get something new, and you want something new, and so on down the line. And there is, of course, a bunch of different ways to kind of flesh that out in reality. That's more kind of like a TV show appearance of what we find. We're usually not that obvious. Our neighbors buy something, so we have to buy something. It's usually a bit more subtle than that. So if we look over in verse 4, that's where that is found. Then I saw that all toil and all skill and work come from a man's envy of his neighbor. This also is vanity and striving after the wind. So the idea here is someone working hard and becoming proficient in their profession, which is difficult to say, two times fast. And they do that for the intent or for the purpose of just keeping up with their neighbors. So, by the way, small little question for you. When the Old Testament refers to one's neighbor, who is in reference? Anybody? The house? Anybody else? Not the house. All right. Any other thoughts? Never thought about it. Well, that's a good question to ask, because somebody asked Jesus that once, right? Who then is my neighbor? I've done all these things for my neighbor. Then Jesus said, you know, who then is my neighbor? What was the response that Jesus gave to the question, who then is my neighbor? He gave a story. The story of the Good Samaritan, right? Who was a Samaritan? It was someone that essentially, if you want to kind of dumb it down completely, is someone that was a half-breed Jew. They kind of had a Jewish heritage, but they weren't really pure-blood Jews. They had a different religion that was based on them worshiping on a certain mountaintop. And they were kind of the ones that were so unclean that the Jews traditionally would not interact with them. Of course, that all kind of broke down when Jesus went to John chapter 4 to the Samaritan woman at the well, right, and had that conversation with her. So a Samaritan man is the one that when he sees someone beaten half dead, by the way, biblically you can be half dead, and you see someone in distress, the Pharisee walks by, the priest walks by, a dirty Samaritan is there, an unclean Samaritan, and he's the one that bandages him up, puts him on his own donkey, takes him to the next town, makes sure he's taken care of, and promises to pay for all the things that he would need for recovery. That person was neighbor to his countryman, to the person who's a human in this instance. So the question was again answered, who then is my neighbor? Everybody is. Doesn't matter who they are. If they're Jew, if they're Gentile, everyone is your neighbor. When I was a new convert, I remember reading about the Old Testament law and how they were to regard their neighbor. And I thought of it more in a literal way, I remember. I guess in theory this works, but not really in practice. My thought was, well, you know what? If we have a community and everyone is looking out for their neighbors, the people that live directly next to them. If we all do that collectively, then we're all looking out for each other. Again, that works in theory, but how well do you really know your physical neighbors? Some more than others, right? So anyway, the neighbor mentioned here in verse 4, I kind of wanted to just go down that road for a little bit and then kind of come back to our thought. Just a curious idea. A lot of things mentioned in here, again, are just from Proverbs. They're just from wisdom that he's attained, that if you don't really know the context behind that phrase, behind that thought, there's a lot more there than meets the eye. So again, verse 5, the fool folds his hands. What does that mean? Does nothing. I like that. I give the illustration of someone who folds his hands to go slumber into sleep. He kind of closes his hands up and puts his head down, you know, one more hour, toss and turn. And that's in Proverbs, of course, the man who tosses and turns in bed. It's like a door on a hinge, you know. So anyway, if you don't connect those two things, it can be a bit confusing, right? So we left here, I believe, 7 and 8, verses 7 and 8. Any questions or comments before we dive into this? This is a whole kind of different thought. Okay, Ecclesiastes chapter 4, in verse 7. He's made remarks about work, about one's intent behind working, about how we think about what we have, and then he launches into this different thought. Again, I saw vanity under the sun. So kind of just a red flag if you're reading this and you're not already aware. When you see in the English a transitional phrase like again, we don't say again usually to repeat what we've already said. We say again to emphasize something that we're trying to make more clear. So again, I saw vanity under the sun. So this next thing is going to be one thing that he noticed that also is not the meaning of happiness or contentment. One person who has no other, either son or brother, yet there is no end to all his toil. So what do you learn so far about this? Let's break it down clause by clause. You got a guy who has no one else in his life. I say guy, colloquial again, just kind of meaning person, right? You got a guy who's got no family, no one else next to him, no one with him, and it is working a whole lot, right? That's part B of clause in verse 8. And his eyes are never satisfied with riches. So you got a guy who's not looking to provide for someone else in his family or in his household. He's working a whole lot. He wants to acquire things, and these things never end. There's always something else. Again, the idea of contentment is all the way throughout this book if you're just looking for it. So he never asks, "For whom am I toiling and depriving myself of pleasure?" This also is vanity. An unhappy business. So he kind of begins it and ends this sandwich with the bread of this is vanity, right? And the meat there in the middle of that sandwich is you've got a guy who's working not to be content and to provide for someone else. He's just looking to acquire, and there's never going to be an end to him working and laboring to acquire. Now keep in mind, this is way before you could just go to Amazon and then ship Prime whatever you are thinking about to your house in one day or less. This is a world that's not as advanced in technology as we are, but they're still dealing with the problem of people working just to acquire stuff that's not going to make them feel fulfilled. It's an interesting thought, how far we've come in society. And yet how much we're still relying on the wisdom of people that are ancients compared to us, right? Any thought about that? Different perspective, different idea? Jim? Might be it. Yeah. You know, I'm told that the first million is the hardest one to get. I've heard that in a movie or two somewhere. And then after that, you're golden. Like, if you can get 1 million, hey, you're good to go. I guess that's a goal to shoot for, but at the end of the day, you look at people that are rock stars, people that are movie stars, and they've got way more than 1 million, and they still have revealed they can't find happiness.
I want my second video,
There was a guy, I forget his name, it's some other name that I probably can't pronounce, but he's known by the tagline Notch, and only maybe one or two of you might know that name Notch. This guy Notch, which is a gamer tag, is a guy who invented this video game based off a few concepts from other video games. And this video game kind of revolutionized video games for like the past 10 years or so. It really changed everything. It's a game called Minecraft. Ever heard of Minecraft? A few parents have, because your kids won't stop talking about Minecraft or grandkids. Minecraft basically is a digital version of Legos. If Legos had a survival version, you had to just get food, protect yourself from zombies, all that kind of stuff that kids love to play. But this guy Notch that made it, his game and his company was so successful, Microsoft bought it out for a couple billion dollars. That's how successful it was. He went from just a kind of part-time indie game developer to a guy who was a billionaire overnight. And he went and he bought a house in LA. And he was really proud that he could move from where he was in Sweden, I think it was, all the way over to Los Angeles and could just buy a house in LA with cash. And he actually bought the house that Tom Cruise wanted to buy, but he outbid Tom Cruise, to give you an idea of how rich this guy was. And I remember reading an article that I saved because I saw it in there. He felt completely foreign in that country, in that land of LA. Not because he was a foreigner, but because everyone around him was just caught up in this environment of being famous for being famous. And here this guy was, he could get any kind of interview he wanted, he could buy anything he wanted in the world, essentially. And he was saying the number one feeling that he felt after he got rich and famous, can you guess what it was?
Loneliness.
Can you imagine why he felt lonely? Before he had all his money, he had a girlfriend, but after he spent so much time building this game from the ground up, his girlfriend left him. So now he's rich, he's famous, he bought Tom Cruise's proper house over there in LA, and now he's got all this attention from beautiful women who would otherwise not give him the time of day before he was a billionaire. So now he was confused and he was frustrated because he could not tell which one of his brand new friends was there because of him or there because he was famous and rich. So when Solomon, the most wise, wealthy, powerful man in all the world at this point, says, you know what? I've seen people that don't have anyone else in their life. And they're working hard, and there's no end in sight. This is pointless. I think Solomon maybe felt that a little bit. He was rich, he was powerful, but he was really kind of alone. Although he had 1,000 women in his life, no doubt he felt lonely as well. Okay, questions or thoughts? I'm glad that I remembered that article. That seemed like a pretty good illustration. All right, verse 9. He kind of goes into this a bit more. I think what we're seeing here is a lonely heart expressing its grief. Two are better than one. Because they have good reward for their toil. They're just kind of cut off. I was making a joke. Verse 10. For if they fall, one will lift up his fellow. But woe to him who is alone when he falls and has not another to lift him up. So we pause there. We think just in a normal, general, observational way, just thinking logistically, if you've got two people, they are better suited to survive, better suited to work, if they're together. When Jesus sent out his disciples in the limited commission, how'd they send them out? Two by two, right? They had someone that went and someone also that went with them, so they went together. Is there wisdom in that? Yeah, So we see here in 9 and 10, he's simply saying, hey, look, it's not good for someone to be alone. If you look a little deeper and just imagine for a moment the wisdom that he's sharing, look in verse 10. For if they fall, one will lift up his fellow, but woe to him who is alone when he falls and has not another to lift him up. When I read that, if you kind of look between the lines, it seems to indicate Solomon at some point or another has been alone and he fell and he was by himself. At least he felt that way. If that's true, then we know someone who's speaking from experience about the wisdom of having people in your life, having people around you. You know, I'm talking about a spouse, talking about just a woman in his life, talking about just a close friend, or just in general having people around you. Whatever the case, he's lived through it, it seems like, and he's imparting that wisdom unto us. Verse 11, again, if two lie together, they keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? I hope this is not as sad as it sounds for the man who had 1,000 women in his life to say, you know what, when you're sleeping alone, it gets cold sometimes. Not just physically, I'm sure, because he was a king. He could have whatever he wanted. You know, he can have coals under his bed like the old times, you know. He's just saying, you know what, sometimes it gets cold when you're alone. Verse 12. And though a man might prevail against one who is alone, two will withstand him, and a threefold cord is not quickly broken. What's it mean by a three-cord fold is not quickly broken? What does that mean? Piece of rope. All right. What is rope? You all look at me like I'm stupid. What's rope? You know what rope is. You ever take apart a piece of rope? Yeah, you got string, right? And then you have the string that's kind of wrapped together. And then they take those cords and then they wrap them around each other. All rope is just really strong cords because they're all kind of meshed together. But if you look at just one strand of the string, it's not that strong. But you get a good strong rope together, that thing is strong as all get out, right? Y'all see that down here?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, anyway, he's saying that in verse 12. And now while he's thinking, I think about himself and about what he's gone through, what he's learned from being alone. He's going to kind of launch into this. I think, and this is my opinion, again, this is basically all my opinion. This is kind of an open book of wisdom literature where you can look at it from a bunch of different ways. I'm giving you how I look at it. You may have a different thought. Again, share that. This is kind of a discussion class, right? I'm not preaching at you. So verse 13, we always wonder, when did Solomon write this? When did he write it? And we want to know that, I think, because I want to know if this is him changing his life at the very last minute, of him waking himself up from all the wisdom and sin that we found him in the history books. What sins did he commit that we're referring to right now? Idolatry wasn't great. That was kind of the big one, right? What led him towards the path of encouraging idolatry in Israel? Well, he had a bunch of wives. And these bunch of wives came from different lands, different kings, different nations, as tribute, as a treaty, as a peace accord. So he would marry one of their daughters to just kind of have them in the family. So they're okay. These two kings are okay because, you know what, I married your daughter. Hey, we're good to go. That's kind of the way it was, right? So how many? He had 1,000 women total, wives and concubines, in his harem, if you will. So idolatry was not great. What else did he do? I can think of one big one, a direct command from God. Do not multiply horses unto yourselves. What does that mean? Do not get war chariots to go to battle with you. You're not going to be relying on horses to win the victory. You've got to rely on me. What did Solomon do? Almost immediately got Egyptian horses in his armory, in his army to help win warfare. So he didn't need them, fortunately, for a lot of major conflicts. It was a time of peace, generally, in Solomon's reign, but he still did that. So we really don't want to look at the life of Solomon on a negative note and say, you know what? He died in idolatry. He died in sin. Maybe Solomon, the wisest man on the entire earth, didn't make it to paradise. We don't want to say that, right? None of us do, I don't think. Verse 13 is the only clue that I can find that maybe indicates to us, and this is again a maybe, not for sure statement, he wrote this at the end of his life as that kind of triumphant repentance that God was looking for from this man. Verse 13, this is just a thought. Better was, past tense, a poor and wise youth than an old and foolish king who no longer knew how to take advice. If you're reading this book like a novel or like a history account, and you're not slowing down and feeling the emotion in this poetry section, you may just read over this. I know I have for a very long time. Verse 13 seems to indicate to me the possibility, at least, that Solomon's an old king who's been going down the wrong road for too long, and this is his effort to be honest with himself and to be honest with his people that he's a ruler over and say, you know what? I was better when I was a foolish, simple, poor, wise king. Now I'm old and I've gone down the wrong path for too long, not taking the advice of the people who, no doubt, when he made decisions that were sinful, that were unpopular, the priests came forward and said, and the prophets came forward and said, look, what you're doing violates this book that you wrote when you first became king, when you copied it for yourself. This is a problem. And he goes, not a big deal. We'll keep going forward. So that's one thought behind that. Any different thought about verse 13 or the previous context? Yeah. Right. You know, if a prophet came to him and said, look, what you're doing is not right, you need to change, and he ignored him, that's not like David did. David made mistakes, but as soon as he was confronted with that mistake, he repented immediately and tried to take that punishment for himself, not for those that he affected. Okay, verse 14. For he went from prison to the throne, through in his own kingdom he had been poor. I saw all the living who move about under the sun, along with that youth who was to stand in the king's place. There was no end of all the people, all of whom he led. Yet those who come later will not rejoice in him. Surely this also is vanity and striving after the wind. Even his own kingship seems to be meaningless in the light that everyone who's living in this world is going to the same end. There's no real point in being leader over a people who has the same end as you. Okay, in chapter 5, we transition again from thinking about work, thinking about life, thinking about family probably, to now talk about God. This is a preview of what he's going to conclude in chapter 12. If you know chapter 12, don't think about that yet. All right? Don't think about oranges. What'd you think about? Oranges. Anyway, chapter 5, verse 1. Guard your steps when you go to the house of God. To draw near, to listen, is better to offer the sacrifice of fools, for they do not know that they are doing evil. All right, so what wisdom is he imparting to us in this first area, this first realm of the spiritual realm? When you go to meet God, mind your steps, mind your words, mind your action. What's the application for Christians in the New Testament today? What do we learn from this as Christians? We don't go to the temple anymore, do we, to offer sacrifice? So what do we learn from verse 1 here? Nothing? All right, pay attention to what you're doing. I see a general warning here. We're to learn from the mistakes of the past, right, from the Old Testament. And when the wisest man in the entire world, up until this point, at least, is telling you when you go to meet God, you better be careful Because it's better for you to just be there and listen, meaning without speaking, than to go and do all this stuff that fools are doing before God. That's a good warning for us to know that what we do before God, even in worship today, is significant, it's impactful, it's meaningful, and how we approach God needs to be taken with consideration. And there are a bunch of different avenues we can use to explain that. Okay. Yeah. 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 All right. That's good. That's good. Okay, verse 2. In a similar kind of vein of thought, do not be rash with your mouth, nor let your heart be hasty to utter a word before God, for God is in heaven, and you are on earth. Therefore, let your words be few. Now, I've seen people in verse 2 kind of go a bit crazy with it. There are a few verses you can take out of its original context and try to bind upon people today. I've heard verse 2 hilariously used to try and say that if your prayers to God in public assembly are over a certain limit, then you shouldn't be leading a public prayer. Obviously, we don't have that in the New Testament, right? That's not the intent of this purpose. The intent of this particular verse, no doubt, in my estimation, seems to be just be mindful of what you say. Don't say something just kind of off the cuff to God, because God is your creator. He's the one that made you. If you make God a promise or a vow, He's going to want you to be honest with what you say. Jesus kind of said the same thing in a different way, I think, when he first began the Sermon on the Mount. And he got to the area about communication with God. And he's kind of rebuked the Pharisees and the Sadducees of his day by saying when they talk to God, they go on the corner of the street and they lift up their eyes and they raise their hand and say great words over and over and over again. And then, to show God they mean business, they'll even swear by something that their words are true. And Jesus kind of rebuked that in a way, saying, if you have to swear by something that you're saying the truth, you must not be telling the truth very much. It's an interesting thought. So anyway, verse 2 kind of has that idea. Any different thoughts or questions or opinions or whatever word you want to use? Okay, verse 3. So, I don't know if you know this about me. This is a personal, close, guarded secret. But I am a dreamer in the most literal way. Almost every night, I dream something, and usually it's chaos. Melissa, unfortunately, knows the extent of this. I am the most busy person you've ever seen in my dreams. I can't just have a nice dream where I go and relax or just have complete nothingness. I'm always doing something. It's always crazy. I'm always stressed out. And I wake up and I forget that that's not my reality. And I'm all angry when I first wake up because something happened. And nothing ever happened. And so when I was in preaching school, there was a man named Garland Elkins. And he just kind of off the cuff one day said, well, you know, a dream comes through a multitude of business. Then that was it. I'm like, wait, what? 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 I've never read that verse before. He goes, yeah, a dream comes through multitude of business. I go, is that what dreams are coming from? He's like, well, yeah, that's one verse. Verse 3, for a dream comes with much business. A dream comes through a multitude of business, I think the King James says. So it seems to mean, at least from my perspective, when you're really busy mentally, a dream comes around your way. So I guess I'm more busy in my mind than I think I am. Okay, well, one more story and then we'll keep going. So we were in a car once. I was in a car once with a member of the church, and I had just begun preaching at in West Virginia. We were driving out to a gun range to go shoot some targets or trees or whatever we were shooting. And we were going out there, and he's just looking over at me and saying, what are you thinking about? I'm like, nothing. Okay. What are you thinking about? It's like, what are you talking about? Are we on a date right now? Like, what's going on? She's like, well, I see you over there and you're all quiet. I see your cogs just turning. I'm like, I'm singing a song in my head. That's all that's going on up there. He's like, what? It's like, people look at me and they think that I'm in some deep thought. I'm not in some deep thought. I'm singing a song in my head. Like, that's all that's going on. And he just didn't believe me that I was literally just not thinking about anything. I was just enjoying my day. So anyway, embarrassing story number two for the day. Verse 3, for a dream comes, Larry.
I think this dream here is like that. It's not something you do while you're asleep.
Right.
It's this strong desire you have. I have a dream that one day I'm going to accept it, whatever.
Yeah, well, that's probably right. I'm sure that my dream world bleeding into this is definitely not the right interpretation. But I just want to share that with you.
To make your dream come true.
Right. All right. So a dream comes with much business, right? So if you want your dream to come true, it takes a lot of work. But a fool's voice with many words, and a fool's voice with many words. So one actually works to make it a reality. One just talks about it, right? One walks the walk. One does what? Just talks the talk. And when you vow a vow to God, do not delay paying it, for he has no pleasure in fools. So if you don't pay your vow, what does Solomon call you? Fool. All right. Pay what you vow. It is better that you should not vow than you should vow and not pay. Well, that's definitely true. There's a lesson there for me, I think. Maybe also for you. That kind of rhymed by accident. In verse 5, when you make a promise to someone or even to God, you say that something is going to be done. You make a vow, if you will. It's better to be honest with your word. To be true to your word. Your word is your what? Your bond, right? Usually. So in verse 5, one thing that I learned pretty early in my ministry, I guess, my service, is that when someone asks you to do something and you say, yes, I'll do it, you better follow through with that, because they won't ask you a second time. When someone needs you, when someone wants something from you to help them with, and you say, trust me, I'll be there for you, and you're not, you don't get a second opportunity to kind of re-earn that. So anyway, verse 6, let not your mouth lead you into sin, and do not say before the messenger that it was a mistake. Why should God be angry at your voice and destroy the work of your hands? For when dreams increase and words grow many, there is vanity, but God is the one you must fear. All right, so the contrast here in verse 7 between what we are thinking about, what we want to do, versus what God is doing is significant as well. So God is in the picture here in Solomon's mind while he's thinking about these things. Okay, questions, comments, additions? Okay, verse 8. If you see in a province the oppression of the poor and the violation of justice and righteousness, do not be amazed at the matter, for the high official is watched by a higher, and there are yet higher ones over him. But this is gain for a land in every way, a king committed to cultivate fields. Verse 10, I believe, is connected to verse 8. He who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves wealth with his income. This is also vanity. Let's pause there. So you got verse 8. What's verse 8 mean? How would you rephrase that?
Don't be shocked when you see somebody put down.
All right. And what is the cause of the poor being put down then, would you assume, from this text? Or the context around it? Okay, people worried about their own position? Possession?
Position.
Could be. There was a unprecedented, if you will, amount of information from the major and minor prophets about the land directly after Solomon and the rulers that would come after them, and even after the exile to the foreign invaders. Now, one of the major complaints that God had with the people, especially the princes, it's called, or the rulers, or the governors, is that they were not exacting justice. They were perverting justice among the people, especially the poor. Can you guess why? They were taking bribes. These people were corrupt. They were greedy and they were corrupt. They didn't care about justice, didn't care about balance, didn't care about right and wrong. They cared about what can you give me that I can make this court rule in your favor. So when you see in verse 8, before really any of that takes place in Israel, because Solomon's still in control, it's still generally a righteous place when it comes to the judicial system. He says, when you go to a place and you see poor people being taken advantage of, don't be shocked. This is nothing new. It's happened for a very long time. And then verse 10, to go into the problem here, I believe, he says, when someone wants something like money, they're not going to be satisfied. They're going to keep wanting more and more and more. Verse 11, when goods increase, they increase who eat them. And what advantage has their owner but to see them with his own eyes? I love this. He's saying, you know what happens? This is going to date me, I think. When you have more money, you have more problems. When you've got more things in your life, you're going to find that the only good that you get from those things, including wealth in your life, is that you can just see it and feel proud for a moment, but people are going to come and consume it. Verse 12, in contrast to that, sweet is the sleep of a laborer when he eats little or much, but the full stomach of the rich will not let him sleep. There's a guy called Mike Rowe on TV. Who's Mike Rowe? Maybe the coolest guy I've ever seen on TV. He's just a good old blue-collar American guy with some common sense, right? If you like just general common sense, he sometimes on social media will put a little essay or a little thought about whatever's going on in the political world, for example, and he'll just say, here's what I'm thinking, and this seems to make a whole lot of sense, right? I like Mike Rowe. He's most famous, I think, from one particular kind of reality TV show. What's it called? Dirty Jobs. Y'all heard of it before? What's the whole purpose of that show? It's to bring Mike Rowe, this good old all-American blue-collar guy, and throw him into some of the dirtiest, hard-working jobs this entire world has ever seen. And at the end of the day, how does he usually feel? Dirty? Yeah. Stinky? Yeah. He's exhausted because he's working so hard. Do you wonder how he sleeps at night? You say, how do you sleep with yourself, knowing that you worked hard for what you did today, providing a good service for the community, doing the job that nobody wants to do, but being thankful for it with a good night's rest? No, doesn't quite fit, right? Sweet is the sleep of a laborer, whether he eats a little or much. You know, he's going to sleep well that night because he worked hard. But someone that's rich, who got that way by taking a bribe, perverting and corrupting justice, by taking advantage of widows and the orphans and the poor of this society, God says you're not going to sleep well. Didn't have Ambien back then, right? Anyway, verse 13. There is a grievous evil I have seen under the sun. Riches were kept by their owner to his hurt, and those riches were lost in a bad venture. And he is a father of a son, but he has nothing in his hand. As he came from his mother's womb, he shall go again, naked as he came, and shall take nothing for his toil, that he may carry away in his hand. This is, and we'll pause right there. Excuse me. So what's the problem here? What's the big evil thing mentioned in verses 13 and following? What happened? You got a guy who, from whatever reason, whatever purpose, he was rich, he was wealthy. He made a few bad decisions, and now he's completely bankrupt. He's broke. He's got nothing. He is as naked as the day he came out of the womb. He's got nothing to his name. Now, the warning, I think, here could be applicable in a couple different scenarios. The first one, obviously, is You want to make sure you're being wise with the money that God blesses you with, right? You don't want to take His blessing of what He's given you to provide for yourself, provide for your family, provide for those in need, and then just waste it away. What's the story of someone who just wasted their inheritance? Prodigal son, right? He took all the wealth that was owed to him from his father's estate, right? One third of his full estate. His older brother got two thirds of it. And he took it and he wasted it with prodigal living. A very polite way to say he just did all the stuff he wanted to do and it was gone sooner than he even realized. That's one application. Be wise with the money God gives you. A second application is when it comes to dealing in business, be especially wise. How did he lose this money? A bad venture is in the ESV. What do you have in a different translation for verse 14? Bad investments, that's probably a good idea, right? That's the idea of making sure you're making your money be used wisely, especially in regards to how you use it, how you invest it. And there is a third possibility here I'll mention just because I think it fits the context quite well for our modern application. There's a third way that you can have a whole lot of money and you can just throw it all away. How's that? Bad investment. Gambling's probably on the peripheral here, but I'll mention it because some people have a struggle with that. Some people really have a problem. I don't have any desire to take money that I was given or that I earned and to just let Lady Luck, whoever she is, determine whether or not I get more or back. Usually the house wins, right? The house always wins in the big picture. But I don't have that problem for myself. But for those that do, this application can be very helpful to understand the lack of wisdom that gambling in general has. We used to live in Charlestown, West Virginia, and it was always funny to know when I said Charlestown, West Virginia, very enunciated because it's not Charleston, West Virginia, it's Charlestown, West Virginia. Certain people would know immediately exactly where Charlestown, West Virginia was. I go, you know Charlestown, West Virginia? Oh yeah, the horse track's out there. The casino's out there, right? Hollywood Casinos in Charlestown, West Virginia. Like, oh yeah, I'm a preacher out there. He goes, oh yeah, well look, you need to pray for me. Look, like immediately. It's kind of funny. Anyway, any more thoughts about that? Different opinions? When I asked last time if God cares about money, this is kind of what I was hinting towards. God does care about how you use your money. Verse 16, this is also a grievous evil. Just as he came, so shall he go. And what gain is there to him who toils for the wind? Moreover, all his days he eats in darkness and in much vexation and sickness and anger. Behold, I have seen to be good and fitting is to eat and drink and find enjoyment in all the toil with which one toils under the sun. The few days of his life that God has given to him, for this is his lot. Verse 18, again, is of the same vein of what was mentioned to us before, and it is distinctly different than eat, drink, and be merry. The rhetoric of eat, drink, and be merry simply kind of shows us, well, we're all going to die anyway, so just do whatever makes you feel good. This is not that. This is Solomon saying again to us, maybe even for the third time so far in five chapters, you know what I've seen that actually is not empty, but seems to be kind of in par with what we're trying to do, is to work hard and then reap the rewards of your labor that God allowed you to do. When you work hard, but also you pause for being in the moment of what God has given you and enjoy that moment for what it is, that seems to be not vanity, right? It's not quite the meaning of life, but it's not empty. So that's pretty good. Okay, questions, comments? Yeah, be satisfied. Okay, we're going to pause here because that bell's going off and we're done for the day. Thank you for your attention this morning. We'll be dismissed now for about 15 minutes.